Last year, roughly 7,400 miles away from Connecticut, a novel coronavirus emerged in Wuhan, China. 142 days ago, the first case was confirmed in Washington state.
And it's been just 94 days since the first Connecticut resident was confirmed to have COVID-19. In that time, more than 4,000 Connecticut residents have died, more than 44,000 have tested positive, more than 500,000 people have filed for unemployment, a protest movement has taken to the streets, and everyone's world has completely changed.
And although the pandemic has been on the decline in Connecticut since mid-April, it's far from over. I'm Diane Orson.
And I'm John Henry Smith. Over the next 2 hours, we'll look back at where we've been, what worked, what didn't, and what's next. This is First Wave.
In the middle of January, college students returned to campus for the spring semester. They came from all over the world. One of those students was returning to Wesleyan University in Middletown. The student developed a cough and fever, and as it turns out, had traveled through an airport where another person was confirmed to have the disease caused by the novel coronavirus. At that point, the disease we now know as COVID-19 didn't even have a name.
It was more than a month away from being declared a pandemic. Just 5 cases were confirmed in the U.S. at the time, all on the West Coast. But Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, told NPR that more would likely come.
I would not be surprised at all if we start seeing more in the coming days to weeks.
Out of an abundance of caution, that Wesleyan student was tested and monitored. The test came back negative. Over the next 6 weeks, others who traveled and may have been exposed to the coronavirus were tested, quarantined, and monitored, but no one tested positive.
A month later, samples were being tested in-state, and by March 6th, 42 tests were conducted. All were negative.
But at this point, anxiety was already on the rise, and xenophobia emerged as Asian Americans in Connecticut were confronted with racist attacks because of the virus's origins in China. Attorney General William Tong spoke about the incident in his hometown of Stamford on Connecticut Public Radio's Where We Live.
A Chinese-American woman who's been in this country for decades was checking out at a grocery store, and the grocery store clerk asked her, when was the last time you went to China? Are you from China? And as she was trying to answer the questions politely, the clerk grabbed a spray bottle of disinfectant and sprayed her and her groceries.
18 miles away from Stamford in New Rochelle, New York, the virus was quickly spreading. A lawyer fell ill in late February, and authorities eventually created a one-mile containment zone after it was clear that community transmission was occurring with more than 100 cases. That zone included the use of National Guard troops. Lisa Keller, a New Rochelle resident, described the feelings inside the containment zone to WNYC.
Since this happened a week ago, people were saying, why did they take a week to start this or do anything? And the most frightening part, again, was the National Guard. What are they going to do?
It was clear that if the virus wasn't already in Connecticut, it would be soon. Cases were confirmed in all the surrounding states. Meanwhile, the state was still open. Metro North was still running, including the New Haven line that runs through New Rochelle.
Then on March 6th and 7th, 2 New York residents who worked at Connecticut hospitals tested positive.
At this point, panic buying was underway. Store shelves normally stocked with things like toilet paper, disinfecting wipes, and hand sanitizer were bare.
But still, at this point, no Connecticut resident had tested positive. On the morning of Sunday, March 8th, Senator Chris Murphy gave his assessment of the situation on CBS.
I imagine we have hundreds, if not thousands, of cases in my state. I think we have no concept of the scope of this epidemic yet because we have not been able to test.
And later that day, it happened.
Hello, I'm Chris Dillett. I'm the first confirmed case of COVID in the state of Connecticut.
The Woolton man contracted the coronavirus while at a conference in California.
When I knew I had it in San Francisco, I would say it hit me like a ton of bricks. You know, I was finishing up a demonstration on a show floor And I just walked off and went back to my hotel room. I felt awful. Every part of me hurt. I finally understand that expression, I got hit with a ton of bricks. That's how I felt. Just the compression everywhere. Your fingers hurt. Your toes hurt. It was miserable. It was absolutely miserable.
How tough was it to get tested?
I begged for over a week. The problem is they didn't have enough tests. The state of Connecticut was still dispersing them. So I was treated like I had the flu. I've had the flu. I've even had swine flu. So see, I only get pandemics. That's the only kind of flus that catch me. But I had swine flu. I knew that this was different. This was unique.
Did you think you were going to die?
Yes. I did a couple of times. When you kind of face that and you think, well, this could be it, you do have a certain peace to say, well, I'm fighting as much as I can. And I've done the best I can. And then you just go, well, let me hang in for a little bit longer. Let me hang in. I kept a positive attitude, but yes, I did feel a couple of times like this was the end.
The conference you went to in San Francisco, I assume you were going out there for work. Have you replayed the decision-making process? Because I know it probably wasn't only you. It was probably, you know, hey, the company probably was in favor of you going out there as well. Have you replayed the decision-making process about going out to this conference? How have the discussions been with your superiors since that episode?
Yeah, they were very upset that I got this. My boss, he felt awful. He just kept replaying in his head. I actually asked not to go the week before. And my boss is like, look, we've got everything set up. So yes, my superiors all felt awful. I think in society, we look back too much and we want to assign blame and we want to, you know, if it wasn't me, it'd have been somebody else. So the way I look at it is I got it. Yep. I got it for work. My CEO is awesome. My HR department called or texted my wife every day. My CEO covered all of my medical expenses personally. You know, he paid whatever deductible we had. He paid that out of his pocket.
That's Chris Tillett. He was the first Connecticut resident to test positive for COVID-19 more than 3 months ago. He spent 10 days in the hospital and is now back at work. One of the questions we're asking is when the pandemic became real. For Chris, it didn't become real for him until after he was already sick.
Getting on the plane coming home from San Francisco, looking over and at everybody that's sitting beside me on the plane, not knowing if I'm giving this to other people. There was a baby in the row beside me. I felt so awful to be on that plane, and I felt awful.
Diane, that has got to be one of the most terrifying and guilt-inducing experiences, especially because it's so easy to get sick when traveling. And it's worth noting that the pandemic didn't become real for Chris until after he was feeling sick. So, Diane, when did the pandemic become real for you?
Well, several things happened within a few days of each other, making the pandemic very real for me. First, I got a call that our New Haven bureau was going to shut down. So that afternoon, I went racing over to pick up as many pieces of remote recording equipment as I could. I also work a lot as a musician, and rehearsals and concerts started to be canceled. But I think the most important or profound thing that made me feel this was very real is that I'm the parent of two adult children. One lives in Washington, D.C., and one lives overseas. And we're quite a close family, and we had some really tough conversations about what this would mean. Both of our kids chose to shelter in place correctly, I think so, but it was really hard for me at first to accept that I wouldn't be seeing them in person for quite a long time. But I'm just so glad that we have video and phone chats. It's just not the same. How about you?
Well, being an old sportscaster, the real eye-opener for me was the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Conference led by Glenn Lungarini when he came out and made the move to shut down the winter sports playoffs. It immediately dawned on me that this was not going to be a short-term thing. And then, you know, you talked about your, you know, I know that you have kids and you talk about yours. I mean, it certainly became realer for me when we really had to sit down, my wife and I, and discuss what were we going to do with our daughter? Were we going to wait for the school to make the decision to cancel school? but she was out of school at least 2 days before the school made the final decision to cancel everything. And in fact, I mean, the school sent us a note saying, hey, we noticed Isabella wasn't in school today. And I sent them a long note saying, I think this is going south quickly and you all need to really consider closing up. And then I don't think they did it because of me, but I think that, you know, of course, a couple of days later, they actually did.
This is First Wave, Coronavirus in Connecticut, a special from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Diane Orson.
And I'm John Henry Smith. Once COVID-19 was clinically confirmed to be in Connecticut, public officials turned to a mitigation strategy. Governor Ned Lamont declared civil preparedness and public health emergencies on March 10th, and then just a day later,
the World Health Organization has declared the coronavirus outbreak a pandemic.
The state of Connecticut was beginning to shut down, although at the time many decisions were left to local officials, including the closure of schools. Here's State Education Commissioner Miguel Cardona.
The decision to close buildings and which buildings to close are based locally at this point and with the direction of the local DPH.
One district, Region 14 in Bethlehem and Woodbury, closed all buildings for cleaning on March 10th after a student was exposed. New Haven Public Schools closed 3 days later after the guardian of a student had come into contact with the virus and had been in the building.
Less than a week after Region 14 closed, all public schools in Connecticut would follow suit and move to online classes. And that's how the school year will end, online. Later this hour, we'll hear from students and teachers about the new reality of distance learning and the impact it had on them.
Now, the same week that public schools closed, the governor also ordered all non-essential businesses to close and told restaurants they must move to takeout-only service, setting in motion the greatest economic crisis the state has faced in living memory.
Then on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, Connecticut's two tribal casinos, Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun, agreed to close their doors for the first time since they opened in the early 90s. They didn't have to. Both operate on sovereign land and are not subject to state orders, but close they did. These two entertainment meccas, which stayed open through 9/11 and Hurricane Sandy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, went dark. Connecticut Mirror reporter Mark Pazniokas was at Foxwoods the night they shut down.
The atmosphere was unique. I'm not a gambler, but I've been to a fair number of casinos in my life. And, you know, there is always that incredible energy running through those places all times of the day and night. And it was, you walked past, parts of the casino that were empty, they were dark. The only illumination was some of the slots machines. But to walk in was eerie, and that was what the longtime casino employees said over and over again. They would just look around and couldn't believe it. Rodney Butler, the tribal chairman of the Mashantucket Pequots, had really grown up there professionally. After graduating from the University of Connecticut, he took a job as a financial analyst, and he would be there all times of the day and night. And there was this one long corridor that led to the original gambling floor. And he just stopped and he stared and he took out his phone and he took a picture. And he just said, I've never seen this. Even at 4 o'clock in the morning, when he used to pick up the slots receipts, it would be packed. And in an odd little way, it was a moving moment, you know. But the soundtrack was still playing. There was endless music overhead, and I just noticed that it was Donna Summers playing The Last Dance, and I mentioned it to Rodney Butler, and the look on his face was priceless, and he just said, "Oh my God, every end of wedding song." And it was really perfect. It just captured this moment. It's like, okay, folks, drink up. It's time to go home.
So let's dance, let's dance, let's dance, let's dance, let's dance, let's dance tonight.
With the casinos closed, most employees were furloughed, roughly 10,000 people, contributing to a wave of eventually hundreds of thousands of unemployment claims around the state. But while many were laid off, other workers across various industries were deemed to be essential, and they weren't just first responders or medical staff.
And for those thousands of essential workers throughout the state, working from home was never an option. As Connecticut Public Radio's Ryan Lindsay reports, bus drivers, grocery store, and healthcare workers have had no choice but to risk contracting COVID-19 while working through the pandemic.
Joe Jarmy remembers buying groceries for the first time during the pandemic.
I went shopping that first week just to get some stuff for myself. And basically, you know, the person next to me was spending like $675, where I was spending $100.
That was back in March. Jarmy is a meat cutter at Stop and Shop in Madison.
The wealthier areas actually got hit first. And then when people started getting their paychecks and stuff, for 5 days in a row, we had completely empty meat cases. We had nothing to sell.
He said it was like people were shopping for a snowstorm again and again. Since then, things have slowed down a little bit. But Jarmy says many customers still don't fully respect social distancing rules, which puts his health at risk.
They come right up to you. They tap you on the back, you know, stuff like that. They just don't get it.
In a time of mass unemployment, workers who remained on the job might seem fortunate. But being deemed essential carries the risk of infection, and along with it, other struggles. While Stop and Shop offered 10% hazard pay to its employees, other companies did not bump wages. Essential workers fought a months-long battle with the state for automatic access to workers' comp payments, which remains unresolved. And then there was protective equipment. When the pandemic started, Jarmy said they didn't have any PPE. Now, Stop and Shop provides masks for employees.
They give you a mask every week. You get a clean one. Because I work in the meat department, they've been giving me one extra mask because it gets wet and, you know, you get meat on it and so on and so forth. It's not the best place to be wearing a mask, to be honest with you, because it's cold, it's damp, it's wet.
For some essential workers, the fear of infection became a reality. Willie Medina has been a bus driver with Norwalk Transit for 12 years, but since contracting COVID-19 while on the job, he says he's considering leaving bus driving behind.
The new normal, because we're never going to get back to normal, but the new normal, it's very daunting. It's very, like, there's so many uncertainties that you don't know what's going to happen. These people are taking the early retirement, so now I'm going to be most likely in a position to be more out there with the public.
For frontline healthcare workers, a lack of PPE has been particularly alarming. Martha Marks works as a visiting nurse in New London. Marks spoke during a virtual roundtable with unionized healthcare workers in early April.
Being a healthcare worker in home care has been hell for the last month. We are not flattening the curve. A month ago, we were not allowed to wear masks in the homes because we didn't want to scare the community.
And Marks is still fired up. She says while masks have become the new normal, she still worries about being in close contact with her patients who are 70 and older.
Best practice is not using the same mask all day long and then throwing it away. Every surgical mask is supposed to be used one mask, one person. We continue to have to use the mask for multiple patient surgical masks. Our N95s, when we have COVID positive patients, this is both in the hospital and in home care, we then save it for next time we see that patient.
Mark says she's upset that her employer isn't offering to test nurses every week or every other week.
I'm nervous. I'm scared. I do everything I'm supposed to do. We bleach everything. I wipe the doorknobs off. When I have a COVID positive patient, they're the end of the day. I come home, I strip down, I shower, I cut my hair short. So I'm doing everything as perfectly as I can.
She says the coronavirus has changed how she feels about her job.
For 35 years, I've been a nurse, and all I have done is take care of my patients. And I was then starting every single day with the fear that I was going to cause harm to my patients. I love being a nurse, and the pandemic became real for me when I no longer loved my profession.
Throughout this wave of the pandemic, essential workers have been regularly hailed as heroes. But for many, that sentiment hasn't been backed up by adequate action to keep them safe, either physically or financially, on the job. Ryan Lindsay, Connecticut Public Radio.
Throughout this special, we'll be remembering some of the more than 4,000 Connecticut residents who have died from the coronavirus. We'll start with Laura Gansey, who remembers her father, 74-year-old Michael Gansey of Newington.
My mom got sick. I knew it was bad because I would call and she couldn't talk and my dad was taking care of her. And that's just like very unusual. I got my dad on the phone and he was like out of breath and he was saying he had just cleaned up the bathroom. And I was like, Dad, please put a mask on. And then my dad was rushed to the hospital on Monday. Thursday, she texted that he picked up his phone, but he couldn't speak because he was having a coughing fit. He was intubated later that day. My last text from him was the 18th, and it just said, got corona. And I just wrote this whole thing about, like, I love you, and he just wrote back, love you. And that's the last text that I got from him. So he began to decline. His doctor was extremely warm. He called each one of us, and we were able to say goodbye through his cell phone that he had in a plastic bag on speakerphone.
That was Laura Gansey, remembering her father, Michael Gansey of Newington. You're listening to First Wave, Coronavirus in Connecticut. Coming up, the economic toll of the pandemic and the damage in the state's nursing homes and prisons. We'll be back after this break. This is First Wave, Coronavirus in Connecticut. I'm Diane Orson.
And I'm John Henry Smith. The public health emergency caused by the coronavirus pandemic has been massive worldwide, and in turn, so has the economic crisis.
I think the economy has been put effectively into a medically induced coma.
That's the editor-in-chief of The Economist, Zanny Minton-Beddoes, speaking on the Marketplace Morning Report. She was talking about the global economy, but Connecticut was doing the same thing.
So far, more than 600,000 unemployment claims have been filed during the pandemic. Nearly every corner of the economy was hit hard, but the worst impact has been in the leisure and hospitality sector. That includes the restaurant industry, which had to rely on takeout and delivery service for 2 months, something that not every restaurant was equipped for. Phil Barnett is co-owner of the Hartford Restaurant Group.
Our business is built with on-premise, which would be consuming, you know, the products within our establishment. We're losing right now about, you know, 80% of our revenue that our staff members depend on, as well as we employ many staff members to work within the on-premise aspect of the business, whether you're a server, whether you're a bartender, a host. So yeah, it's unfortunately, you know, the reality is here and it puts us in a really tough position right now.
Well, it was a tough position indeed for Phil Barnett's restaurants, which include Wood and Tap, and it was a tough situation for restaurant employees across the state.
My name is Brooke Burlett. I reside in Glastonbury, Connecticut, and I am still employed from Ted's Montana Grill. I worked at the Hartford location on Front Street. I was furloughed at the beginning of this pandemic. And currently, I am still furloughed and not working. I fortunately have been able to claim unemployment. I did have to spend quite a few hours calling and recalling back to the Department of Labor because I needed to get in touch with an actual person who worked there. There is no sitting on hold option. You have to call, hang up, call, hang up, call, hang up. I compared it to when I was younger and was trying to win concert tickets from a radio station of just incessantly hanging up and calling back, and it ended up working.
While the restaurant industry was among those hardest hit, no sector was spared.
So my name is Maria Cardona, and I was working at the Phoenix Building in downtown Hartford. Just cleaned offices. I thought I was only going to be out for like 2 weeks till we were able to go to another building. But then this happened out of nowhere. And then they're like, okay, you guys are also stopping. You guys are not working here no more, but you guys can't go nowhere else either. I have my 2-year-old son that needs insurance, and right now I have to take him to the doctor, and he was also supposed to go for his 2-year physical, but with no insurance, I can't bring him.
My name is Randall Van Cole. I'm a security officer at the Hartford Insurance Company. They closed the building down, so, you know, without any employees, there's no need for me to provide a service. It was kind of difficult. It was very difficult. I was 7 weeks without unemployment. I mean, when you have the rug taken from underneath you with no recourse, it's difficult. You know, it's just took me way off track. And as a result of that, I had to really, really watch every cent that I bought in, but I survived.
Randall Van Cole was one of more than 500,000 Connecticut residents who filed for unemployment benefits since the start of the pandemic. And filing for unemployment requires resources to process those claims. Some of those resources at the State Department of Labor, the computer systems, were 40 years old, far too brittle to handle this surge. And joining me now to discuss the challenges of meeting that need are Labor Commissioner Kurt Westby and Deputy Commissioner Dante Bartolomeo. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having us.
As the governor began to announce business closures in the middle of March, did you have any idea of the tidal wave of claims you'd be facing?
We knew there would be a lot more, but I don't think anyone had any idea of the tsunami of claims that would be coming. Not only the absolute numbers of claims, but the rapidity at which those claims came. We've never had anything like that at DOL. Even in the last Great Recession, there were about 10,000 claims a week. We're talking at the peak here, many, many more claims by a factor of 6 or 7 per week.
And how does that compare to like a normal year?
It just blows it out of the water. We've had in less than 3 months, over 4 years of normal, what we would call normal claim activity.
Mm. And I understand the department was pretty lean in terms of staff as you went into this crisis.
We've, over the years, been defunded by the federal government. We actually went through layoffs in 2015. We've reduced the employment levels at DOL since then because we simply could not afford it. Over the last 4 years, we have incurred in most of those areas of UI staff decreases of 50%. A lot of our staff have been working 14-hour days since March 13th. It's been a staggering piece of work.
The staff, as the commissioner mentioned, are working around the clock, and literally have been since March 13th when all of this began. And, you know, they want to be doing that because the folks that we serve, they're their neighbors, their community members, their families. This is hitting everywhere. It doesn't discriminate, you know. And so that's been something that we've been incredibly proud of the dedication.
I know that you've had another challenge. Your computer system was pretty antiquated.
There was many, many years, at least a decade, where we had been trying to get an improvement, a modernization in our old computer system, because we knew that the COBOL-based 40-year-old system would not last very long. But unfortunately, in the economy since the Great Recession, there have been so many other priorities. So whether it's mental health services or education and all of these things, school safety, that are very, very important, it were competing priorities for funding. So the Department of Labor computer system until now hadn't necessarily been seen as a priority, but now we are a lifeline to people. We are their safety net.
We have heard many, many, many stories of people having to wait weeks to have their claims processed or spending hours on the phone. What do you say to those people?
Try to be patient. I know it's difficult. We've shifted 40 people from other positions to try to help out with the calls, with our email system. That has helped, but it has not been enough. We're talking just tens of thousands of calls and emails coming in every day. We urge folks to be patient. We are bringing on 20 more staffers to deal with calls, and are going to be bringing on increments of 20 after that, as well as standing up a state-of-the-art call center to deal with that problem also.
So honestly, can you say things are getting better?
I can say things are getting better with a caveat. For those who are still waiting, things are not getting better, but we are getting to them very fast.
You know, we've already seen our unemployment rate go from, you know, the mid 3.something% up to about 18% last I knew. So in addition to the federal extended, we now have our regular quote unquote state extended benefits and possibly even high extended. So there is an indicator that we're talking with at least those programs covering people until the end of the year, potentially, which tells me that it's not going to wrap up too quickly.
Well, that's all we have time for now. Labor Commissioner Kurt Westby and Deputy Commissioner Dante Bartolomeo, thanks for talking.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
While Connecticut was shedding jobs by the hundreds of thousands, the cause of that economic crisis, COVID-19, was surging. A week after the first case was reported, 68 people tested positive. A week after that, 618. On the last day of March, the state of Connecticut said there were more than 3,100 confirmed cases of COVID-19. 608 people were hospitalized, and 69 people had died.
The hardest hit region was Fairfield County, due in part to its proximity to New York City. The virus was silently spreading in early March. The New York Times reported about a house party in Westport on March 5th, days before any cases were confirmed in the state. But that became what the paper called Party Zero. Roughly 50 people from all over the region and one person from South Africa came together to celebrate a birthday. Then they dispersed, went to their jobs in New York City, went to other parties, and went about their lives without knowing that some of them had and were spreading the coronavirus. By the time they got sick, it was too late. Kristen Hussey co-reported the story.
The reaction from people in the town as the news started coming out was fear. It was what you would see anywhere. Just no one knew enough about the virus to give definitive answers, and that's so frustrating.
As the surge continued and field hospital sites were stood up by National Guard troops, two separate realities of the pandemic emerged just in our small state. While there were more than 2,000 cases in Fairfield and New Haven counties, with nearly 500 hospitalizations at the end of March, the eastern part of the state at that point was still relatively untouched. In New London and Windham counties, there were just 38 confirmed cases and 8 hospitalizations. Hospitals in the hardest-hit regions were under immense stress. Sarah Newman is a nurse manager at Yale New Haven Hospital, and she's been a nurse for nearly 40 years.
This is nothing like anything I've experienced. I lived through the AIDS crisis in the 80s in New York. We've had H1N1. I was here in the hospital for 9/11, waiting for ambulances to come from New York. We actually had a rule-out Ebola patient here at Yale New Haven, which we prepared for on the fly. But I've never seen anything like this.
That part of the state was getting hammered by the virus, and it was also spreading in other communities, especially nursing homes. The coronavirus preyed on Connecticut's most vulnerable citizens. Now, while it's known that the elderly and those in need of long-term care are at high risk of contracting respiratory illnesses, the degree of the devastation COVID-19 has wreaked on the state's nursing homes has been shocking to behold. Here to talk more about that is Connecticut Public Radio's Frankie Graziano. Frankie, of all the COVID-19 deaths statewide, more than half have been nursing home residents.
And if you factor in numbers from the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services nationwide to state data, 10% of nursing home deaths due to COVID-19 in America happened in Connecticut. That's startling. And what's also startling about Connecticut's numbers is that data on infections and deaths shared by the Department of Public Health, they don't include staff contracting COVID-19 or dying from that. So who knows what the necessary numbers are, the real numbers of how many people are getting sick in nursing homes.
Just startling numbers. You know, we've established now, of course, that nursing home residents represent an at-risk population. What else might explain why coronavirus has cut such a catastrophic swath across that population?
One thing I think, John Henry, we didn't know about early on was that the dreaded asymptomatic carrier may be to blame, penetrating a system that like pretty much locked down immediately after the virus became a factor in the area. But I talked to Matthew Barrett, the president of a trade association that represents like 145 nursing homes. He offered one thing the state could have done early on.
I think there has to be an evaluation about whether or not hospitals being overrun in Connecticut and across the country, as hard as it was to estimate it, and it's how well-intended it was to get estimates on hospital surge, whether or not we overestimated that. And that led to more resources being put into that part of the system at the expense of nursing facilities downstream.
What about PPE, personal protective equipment? Now, there was a massive shortage in the beginning of the pandemic that prompted some lawmakers to ask the president to federalize the supply chain. Now, how did this lack of PPE manifest itself in the nursing homes?
Here's an idea of what staff at these long-term care facilities have been going through. It comes from Zena Bennett. She's a CNA at St. Joseph's Manor in Trumbull.
A lot of times we're running out of gowns. Everybody in our building is not getting N95s. They're only being select about who they give it to.
Specifically on the shortage of gowns, John Henry, maybe the most seminal moment of the pandemic for nursing homes was when the state's largest healthcare workers union shared a photo of a worker wearing a trash bag in lieu of a protective gown. On an April media call, a Department of Public Health official, her name is Barbara Cass, said while she couldn't comment on specific photos,
we too have heard the stories and have followed up on the trash bag. And in many of those cases, in all of the cases thus far, that has been the preference of the employee. It has not been supported by the employer, but that's what they felt comfortable with doing.
That struck a nerve with reporters on the call and with the union. To be fair to Cass, she was recounting what she had been told. It's just representative of how hard PPE was to come by and how much scrutiny the DPH was under.
Wow. COVID-19 cases in Connecticut continue to dwindle. Naturally, people have the next uptick in the back of their minds, though, in a time that's still shrouded in a lot of uncertainty. Now, do you have some keys for what nursing homes need to do in anticipation of a potential coronavirus second wave?
Barrett told me, he's the president of the Association of Skilled Nursing Facilities, he says three things are important. Increased testing, that's regular screening of residents and workers, an abundance of personal protective equipment made available to mitigate the workers' exposure, and staffing in general. Two things quickly, John Henry. Governor Ned Lamont recently ordered universal testing of staff in all Connecticut long-term care facilities. And two, regarding the staffing, the state created a temporary nurses' aide certification so that unlicensed workers could be hired to meet a potential staff shortage, provided they've got some training.
We could talk for much longer about this, Frankie, but we have to leave it here. Frankie Graziano on the impact of COVID-19 on nursing homes.
On Monday, after we spoke with Frankie, Governor Ned Lamont ordered an independent review of Connecticut assisted living facilities and nursing homes. Lamont says he wants an analysis of how the pandemic was addressed in these facilities. He says he wants this completed before the fall in case there's a second round of the virus. Now to talk more about some of the issues Frankie raised, we're pleased to bring in Rob Burrill, president of SEIU 1199 New England, which represents many of Connecticut's nursing home workers. Thanks for your time.
Of course, thank you.
We just heard a representative of the nursing home employers say that Connecticut put too much of its resources early on into helping hospitals build out their capacity. He says that not enough help was given at the start of the crisis to nursing homes. Do you agree with that?
I don't want to focus on statistics because behind each one of those figures is a human being. It's a life that has been lost. But if we look at over 2,000 fatalities in Connecticut nursing homes, over 10% of the resident population having lost their life over the past 3 months, those numbers really speak for themselves. Of course, acute care hospitals, places where people can go to be healed, need to get the majority of the focus in terms of resources. But we knew that going into the pandemic that the elderly are particularly vulnerable, that people with underlying health conditions are an additional vulnerability, and that when you have a congregate care setting, that we could expect that there were going to be real challenges in nursing homes. So it's clear to me that the nursing homes were under-resourced.
Ideally, what would you have liked to have seen?
Number one is that the state should have been in touch with all parties and done the short, medium, and long-term planning necessary to get ahead of the curve. By the way, we've been putting out appeals to the state of Connecticut to engage in medium to long-term planning for months. No response, nothing. But that would have allowed us to say, you know, what's the assessment in terms of personal protective equipment? In many cases, there was literally none. Okay, we had workers that were fashioning their own masks out of cloth, that were making protective gear as late as May, out of trash bags, as late as May. Those were critical issues to make sure that the nursing homes were resourced. And then I would say the other big piece is that there should have been much greater concern paid to making sure that each nursing home had real infection control plans. That would be a critical piece.
What about testing of both patients and staff? I mean, did things move along quickly enough, do you think?
So some of this is there was a national shortage of available testing equipment. Okay, we know that. So if we know that there's a problem in terms of availability of testing, then what you've got to resource people with protective gear. Now that the testing is starting to be implemented, the workers that test positive are going to have to be quarantined for up to 2 weeks at a time, obviously as a safety and precautionary measure. That's good. How are the facilities that are about to hit a hard stop on the funding increase on June 30th going to find the additional staff? What we were seeing in terms of the way that the state has dealt with this is a Medicaid resident population. 80 to 90% of the patients in nursing homes are Medicaid residents. So by definition, poor people with underlying health conditions, disproportionately Black and brown, the workforce overwhelmingly Black, brown, female, low income, okay? And it is time to have a honest discussion about the fact that part of the problem in terms of why the workforce has been neglected and consequently the patient population has been devastated by this illness is the demographics of both populations, low income, female, Black, brown, and working class white. And the suffering and the pain of this population has frankly been rendered invisible.
Rob Baril, really glad you could take some time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Diane.
Throughout this special, we are remembering some of the Connecticut residents who died from the coronavirus. Paolo Ferreira lost his only son, 26-year-old Jonathan Ferreira of Newington.
Jonathan was always a happy kid, was always with a smile in his face. He loved reading books. He used to spend most of his summers back in Portugal with our family. But Jonathan was working every day. He worked 2 weeks in a row. So one day he came home and told us, I'm so tired, I can't go back to work tomorrow. That same day, he started having fever. First week was kind of rough, but then the things were starting to improve and they started getting better. It was getting better and better. And one day, his blood pressure just completely dropped. They had nothing else they could do anymore. And if we wanted to say our goodbyes, they FaceTimed. It looked so peaceful. So we were able to say our goodbyes to him. The nurses said that he could hear us talking to him.
You're listening to First Wave, Coronavirus in Connecticut. Coming up, how teachers, students, and their families have responded to their new reality of distance learning. We'll be back after this break.
This is First Wave, Coronavirus in Connecticut. I'm John Henry Smith.
And I'm Diane Orson. The pandemic has upended all of our lives, particularly a whole generation of school students. They were abruptly sent home in mid-March, and after a lot of uncertainty, finished out the school year online. That was hard for many kids, those for whom school is the only stable environment they have, those who had no laptops and no internet to be able to complete classes, and those who had other family responsibilities.
My dad, he works 3 jobs, and both my parents don't speak fluent English, so I have to really take care of my little sister, who's only 6. So not only do I have to like do my own work, but I also have to take care of her at the same time. And on top of that, I have to juggle with also working.
That's Mumthanu Emila. She's a junior at Naugatuck High School. An English teacher at that school, Megan Sherry, says she's very aware of the challenges her students face.
It's really important for us to think about our students as people. And when we have kids who are waiting in line at a food bank or working 40 hours a week or worried about a sick family member when they don't have health insurance, we can't expect them to care about William Shakespeare. You have to think about what can I provide them that will make this time in their life easier or will make them learn something that's applicable to this experience.
Perhaps the most disappointing moments came for high school seniors who faced this loss of school community at the end of their K-12 experience, with all of the traditions and friendships they had to miss out on. We spoke to 2 graduating seniors to get their thoughts on this year.
Hi, I'm Ashley Pitter. I go to Hartford Public High School.
My name is Omar Small. I went to Hartford Public High.
I was really excited. I was pumped for everything because I had senior friends before and they went through all the things and I wish I was a part of that. And then I was just hoping, oh, it's coming, and then it didn't. And then my heart just broke.
I expected to have the full senior experience, you know, hanging with my classmates, possibly going to prom. I missed out on so many activities, which really kind of hurt.
I thought I would have this memory to look back on for a lifetime. Oh, I spent my last moment with my friends celebrating, a happy feeling. But instead, I'm going to look back at that I was stuck in the house. I was angry that I didn't get the normal graduation.
I just cannot learn online anymore. I thought it would have been fun to learn online in the beginning, but, you know, as time went on, it got boring. It got lacking of human interaction.
Google Classroom experience was the worst for me. I'm a visual learner. I need my teacher to be right in front of me, talking to me. So they posted their notes and stuff, and I had to read it and teach myself. It was harder than being in the classroom.
This quarantine, it's sad. It may have brought some of us together, but it also tore some of us apart.
I only really wish I got to do a senior prank. I look forward to that because all my years at school, I've seen seniors before me do pranks and pranks. And I was just waiting for my turn and I was waiting for senior skip day. I just wish it was different.
Ashley Pitter and Omar Small will receive their high school diplomas at a drive-through graduation ceremony in a parking lot in Hartford this Friday. Both are going on to study at UConn in the fall. Joining me now to discuss some of the issues raised by education during the pandemic is Jeff Leek, president of the Connecticut Education Association, the state's largest teachers union. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
When it became clear to you that schools across the state were going to have to shut down, what were your first thoughts?
My first thoughts were probably, oh, my Lord, I've been doing this for 40 years and nothing like this has ever happened before. Where are we going to go?
And can you walk me through a bit how you started to answer that question?
So we began to talk with leaders in our different locals and try to figure out what was going on there, what resources they had. Some of them reported to us that they had, you know, been kind of moving along in the technology area and felt like they could get some things done with their students. Others were completely relying on, you know, paper and pencil and packets and things like that.
Now, I know the CEA spoke with thousands of teachers near the end of May about how things have been rolling out. What are the key takeaways from what you found?
Key takeaways would be, number one, we all know that distance learning doesn't fully help our students move forward the way we would like. So that's number one. Number two, we can't pretend that there is not this huge discrepancy in Connecticut between districts that have and districts that don't have. Some sent their second and third graders, I think, home with iPads. Some had nothing like that to offer. So that was clear from that.
As terrible as this pandemic has been, if we look at it as a moment to stop and reimagine the future of public education here in Connecticut, where do you think the state needs to begin?
We need to begin with taking a look at how we fund education in Connecticut. For a state such as ours, with some of the wealthiest citizens in the United States of America, and yet some of the poorest as well, we need to get at the fact that the way we're funding education right now, based on local property taxes, doesn't work, and it needs to be examined. I.e., that means that resource availability is going to be more evenly distributed, minimizing the impact on our less economically stable students.
Well, there's so much more we could talk about. We don't have the time now, but we will continue this conversation in the future. Jeff Leake, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Diane. Good to talk with you.
We've been remembering some of the people we've lost in the pandemic. Here is Sandra Tate Eady remembering her friend, 80-year-old Loretta Headley of Bloomfield.
The first time we met, I just remember this bubbly and fun and friendly and warm woman who danced all night. And you could tell she really enjoyed celebration. She just ministered in food. Like, she just loved to cook and she loved to feed people. And so when you would go to her house, you were usually going expecting to eat. And not only during the holidays, I mean, anytime you needed a pick me up, you could drop by. She loved seeing people because she lived alone. And you can be sure that she could go into her freezer and just pull out something and whip you up a plate. She grew up in Barbados, and she grew up in a small parish called St. Peter. So coming to America and, you know, starting as a dietary aide, and with that salary, being able to purchase their own home and provide for her children, you know, that meant a lot. And she was very proud of what she was able to accomplish.
That's Sandra Tate Eady remembering Loretta Headley of Bloomfield. You're listening to First Wave, Coronavirus in Connecticut. I'm Diane Orson. Coming up next hour, we'll continue to look back at this state's handling of the pandemic, including the racial disparities, and how the pandemic intersected with the protests around the death of George Floyd last month. We'll also hear from Governor Lamont, who reflects on how his administration handled the state's response. This is Connecticut Public Radio.